I would be very happy if you'd like to talk a little more about the first 4 years. We did this. Oh, I put it back here. That's what we did that this morning a little bit, so we're going to do it also today. So, could you please talk about embodied emotions and how it is being expressed in our life? Well, sometimes just for vocabulary, sometimes we call embodied emotions affects. In psychology, that's a common way we refer to that. And also embodied emotions are really emotions that are being stored in the unconscious, because you can almost view the body as the unconscious or the vehicle, the container for the unconscious. And so embodied emotions are basically unconscious emotions. And conscious emotions, there's a couple of ways that we experience them. Often, we experience them through projection. We've talked quite a bit about that, which I'll talk more about now. But another way we experience them is just for seemingly no reason. I mean, nothing's really triggered, nothing happens. And some sort of an emotion will arise. It'll just arise, and it will feel embodied. Like you can feel like pain or tension or something in your heart or in your stomach or in your, abdomen. People have different places where they tend to feel those type of emotions. Where do they situate? Everybody, if we went around the room, we'd probably say, well, mine is in my stomach, mine is in my heart. So it just depends on the upadhi, really, where these emotions tend to be felt and tend to just kind of hang there, sit there. And you won't even be sometimes sure of what the real cause of it is. So that's one way. It's as though the emotion, as Swamiji said in that little piece I read you in the Kina, they're trying to get out. It's like holding the example that they used in the Shastra, actually, is holding a bubble underwater. And say you have a bubble in your hand and you have to go very carefully down. If you've ever, as a child, experimented with this, you go very carefully down to hold it, and if you make any tilt or anything, it will come out. It wants to come out. And so we will experience that with unconscious emotions coming out, especially just coming. And I mean, without doing inner child work or without necessarily any kind of a triggered projection. But it can be, It could be, I suppose, a triggered projection that you don't even know has taken place. Like that. Often, usually when we talk about projections, we know because we are having a reaction that's disproportionate to the situation. That's the mark of an unconscious pain inside, is that your reaction is too big, it's too much hurt when seemingly nothing has really happened, you know. So these embodied emotions tend to be able to surface for who knows why. It could be because your body had a little bit more relaxation than it's used to. It can be that. It can be just the kind of natural relaxation that really takes place with this knowledge. It's a relaxation that happens really for everybody who, as you gain this knowledge, there's a certain safety, there's a certain security, a certain solution to a certain freedom. Like you gain an inner sanctuary of safety, and with that inner sanctuary of safety, your body relaxes more than it has ever before, you'd say, because you've never had this knowledge before, and so the level of relaxation is more than the body is used to, and that causes things to just bubble up. And then, of course, the bigger things where there's a real projection taking place, and then you have a big reaction in reference to some event out here, some person or some event. Those are the ones that we're not used to. But I think if I'm just mentioning, sometimes you have feelings or pain in your heart or pain in your stomach or your abdomen or places where those feelings usually take place. And you don't have any idea where that is, what's even causing it. You know, that's also something that is there for you to work with. You don't always know the reason. It's easier to figure out the reason when it's a projection onto somebody or something. It's easier. But in any case, whatever the feelings are that we're carrying, they need to and they want to, we can use that word, they need to and they want to come to consciousness, you know. And you can even go even further and say, you know, they want to be seen. They want, like just if you were a little child, and you're so hurt and so worried and so, you know, scared or whatever, and then your mother or father was there to come and you know, put you on their lap and talk to you all about it and listen to what everything that happened. I really, besides all of our little kids here, I noticed with, remember when Phil and, can I remember?
Helen.
Yeah, Phil and Helen. So they were at the, they were getting ready to go up and eat at the picture hall, and little Munna came bouncing along. She didn't really even touch the little girl, but she was just bouncing, having a good time. And so the little girl, the older little girl, not the little one.
Allo.
She fell over. She was just, you know, she looked at him and lost her balance and she fell down. And then she started to cry and was, you know, upset. And so Phil, you know, just picked her up, and they went and sat on a rock and put her on his lap, and then they had the longest discussion. It was the cutest thing in the world. The longest discussion about what had happened and what the dog had done and what she had thought was what going on, and then he explained all about dogs and. And she was listening, and they were having this good conversation. And after, I mean, I'm saying like 15, 20 minutes. It wasn't 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was the most beautiful thing, you know. So that little trauma, you know, was taken care of without leaving probably any trace whatsoever, because by the time they had done all of this in-depth conversation about the situation, she was happy, they were happy, and then they went off, and little Munna was standing over there, and they were waving to Munna. So Phil was doing what we need to do for the times that we didn't get that. Because if we get that, you know, if the parents take time, realize this is a very serious situation, you know, for the little child, it's a very big deal, you know, for that little emotional, you know, being. And so sometimes we don't realize what a huge thing it is for the little child, and so we aren't able to give or don't think to give that amount of attention. I don't think you can give too much attention. You know, when they're ready for you to stop, they'll just run off and play. It's like, bye. They're gone. So, but now that kind of patience, you know, and seeing something seen and upset through to the end, just being present and being with it, that's really what the little ones inside of us, they also need that. They need us to, as a good mother or father, to be there, to be interested, to understand the situation, to give that kind of love and respect, and also to take it seriously, you know, instead of thinking that you're wrong for being so upset for something so silly, you know, but instead to totally take the situation seriously and be there and let it work itself out so the little one can run off and play, you know. And you can feel that when you're with the little ones inside, you can actually feel the pain and the tension releasing, you know. Some of the bigger traumas, long-term traumas like with problematic parents that you actually have to spend years and years with, it takes a while for that healing to take place, you know. But it does take place and it does happen. You know, and that's a miraculous thing. And also, you've all probably noticed that if you're inside with a little one, you know, where that pain is, it is a very pleasurable pain in a way, because someone is there with you, with that little one, you know. And so there's a love there. And so even though there's pain and hurt, it's being held as it should be, you know. And so there's a tremendous relief that takes place, and you can feel all these deep emotions kind of moving about, you know. And so you know that you're on the right track, because you can feel the little ones inside kind of relaxing and becoming happy again, happy from being very, very sad. Very sad and very hurt. So you know that you're onto something and that something is healing when you have those inner experiences. Yeah? If your mind is like a wall to you, I had one client that I worked with probably for about 12 years. And the first few years, it was nothing but a wall, and it used to really bother her, because she would try. She was also an artist. But she would try to go inside, and she couldn't. You know, she just could not do it. And then she started, so that was initially for the first couple of years, was like that. And then there was a step, and that step was, I'm really terrified to go inside because I don't think anything will be there. You know, like you go inside and it's like a vacant morgue or something. So that was a huge worry for her, and it's not even like a conscious worry, it's one that you don't quite know how to describe what that is, but that's some of the images that were used in it. It took a lot of work, just because of the background, for the defense system to let go enough, you know, so that you have access in and out, which is what we want. We want to be, it's like breathing. We should have as much access internally as we do externally. If you want to be inside or want to be with wisdom figures inside, you just go inside and you're with them. But when we've suffered different degrees of trauma when we're little, the defense system is on guard. And so it has to feel two things, that the one who wants to come in is good, and will be on your side and help you and love you. It has that. And it has to feel that your, and not with thoughts, this is all intuitive, what do you call it, instinctual. It has to know that your psyche can handle it, is strong enough to handle it. And so it kind of, if you know what the word titrates mean, the psyche titrates, it means that it decides how much. Like if you turn on a tap, you can have just little drips coming out, or you can have a little bit more. That's titrating. You decide how much can come at once. So the psyche is able, the defensive system is kind of able to do that. What is safe? That's just a whole, the whole system. The kind of the I say like the infinite, in Bhagavan's infinite intelligence in reference to the complexity of the body-psyche relationship and all of the things, what can be handled and not. So I feel, at least in all of my experience, both in as for myself as a therapist also, is the best thing is to talk to the wall, you know, talk to the defense system, talk to the little ones inside, even if there is no response. Don't think nobody's in there. Somebody's in there, you know, and you're just not allowed in right now. But you can still be a good mother, you know. You can be somebody who loves them and is very, very patient and will always be there, you know. And then you kind of continually check in, you know, feel, it's just like filling the little ones up with love. And then at some point, the walls start breaking down a little bit, and then you have much more access. It's so worth it, you know, and it requires respect and patience and care and all of those things. Just like we would do for each other, you can't pull. We don't do it, and it's not, it's just not right to try to pull things out, you know. You see some pain in there, let's go get it. If you have some sort of aggressive attitude like that, the defense system is much stronger than anything you could ever throw at it. It would just become like, you know, like a steel wall that's like a foot thick and shiny, closed. Nobody inside would even be able to hear if you're knocking them. Yes. Because it protects you. So. But I would always take the time, even in every meditation that you do as part of the meditation, what we call preparatory part of the meditation, is to give some time to the unconscious. See how everybody's doing. You know, who needs some special attention? Is anybody inside hurting or have any problems? Has something been triggered? And just have that be part. So there's always breathing going on between the conscious mind and the unconscious. There's always this kind of flow in and out, which is really how it should be. And once that inner trust is there. And then, of course, whenever something triggers you and you're feeling pain and hurt and you've had a reaction, then it's the same, is to go into where that hurt is rather than going out. You can go out later when you're not hurting so badly, so you don't want to go out to a projection and try to work a projection out in the world. It won't work. It doesn't work. What it can do is, if the person's a therapist or just is a good patient friend, can, and who loves you and knows you very well, can say, well, what's going on? You know, what's happening? You know, what really happened? And if you trust each other, then the person may be able to talk about it, that type of thing. But I think that's all fine. That can also happen. But I think are learning how to go inside ourselves for that inner healing, you know. Or whenever we're upset with somebody, know there's something in you that's really upset, that's really been poked. And to find out what that is and be with it and give it what it needs as a good parent, rather than trying to solve it outside. Then later you can talk about it, but what went on, this is what I went through and all of that. And that also can be very healing to your relationships and things like that. But in terms of really, really healing what's going on inside, then I think you have to do it that way. It helps. So, it's expressed in our, through our life through pain, pain and projection, unconscious material. If it was happy material, it would be not in the unconscious. The unconscious, unless you go deeper into wisdom figures, the unconscious we're talking about here now in terms of embodied emotions, and we're talking about inner child work and traumas that happened when you're young, you know. And so all of those kind of painful situations have been internalized. And those are the ones that we're working with to come out. If all the happy situations are fine, if they're not internalized. Yeah. Only the ones that have caused pain. Pain and worry and that type of thing. Then there's deeper levels for us to go, which we'll be talking about. We do it that with Ishtadevata is like a wisdom figure. We're going into the deeper level that's deeper than the shadow level, which is really just our experiences that we were not able to cope with, and so they're held in the unconscious. If we can cope with them, they're worked out right here and now. There's nothing being held like that, no affect being held. Yeah. This is the one we were working. I had a couple of more ideas which I don't remember right now, but let me read this and maybe it'll come back to me. This is for the children. I would be very happy if you'd like to talk a little more about the first 4 years of a child's life and the relationship to the parents. It is to fill them with love good enough, or what else is important for a child in order to develop a sound personality and loving inner structure. Thank you so much for teaching us. It's invaluable. I'm so thankful. There was a book that came out written by a Chinese, I believe it was a Chinese mother. It was called like The Dragon Mother or something. Anybody know that book? Do you know?
Tiger Mom.
Yeah, The Tiger Mom. It's a great book. Very beautiful. You know, she was, this mother, she had two children as I recall, and she was really, really strict. Maybe too strict, but she was very strict. And one of the things that she believed was very important for her children, besides being so strict, just like a dictator, you know. But she felt that it was very important for a child to accomplish something, to have something about that they're proud of, that they do well, you know. Like say for a little boy maybe he's really good at baseball or something and can do really well. He can hit home runs and everybody's cheering and he runs around the bases, that kind of thing, you know. But for her, it was for her children, I think both of them, if I recall, to practice the piano and to become pianists, to really be able to do it beautifully. I read this book about 5 years ago, so I don't remember the details of it. But I absolutely loved the book. I mean, I think it would be problematic to have her for a mom. And in the end, she also thought it was pretty, you know, pretty hard, pretty difficult. But she gave her children something that they excelled at. And for her and for at least the one daughter, the other one might have been a little bit different. One was more rebellious than the other also. She was so strict, and she made them practice, and perform, and all of these. You know, it's like one of those Hollywood mothers would say, you know, who wants their child to be a movie star or something like that. Except she wasn't like that. It wasn't corny or superficial. She believed that it's very important for a child growing up to be good at something, where they feel skilled, you know, and then also to have the education, the enough education and certain skills or in the arts or whatever, you know, it could be in sports and the arts, where that they have good self-esteem, and then to put them through school so that from her vantage point, you know, that they will get an education, maybe they'll get a doctorate in something, or they'll become a doctor, or that's kind of sound like, it sounds like India to me. They'll become a, because all the kids become doctors. They have to become a doctor, or they become an engineer, or they become a lawyer, or some profession that brings in money and brings in esteem. So that then they have all of the tools that they need to go out into the world and be respected adults. Just is quite this language, but I don't think that's far from what it is to be a person who stands in their own stead, you know, and she felt very, very firmly about giving her children those gifts, you know. And I think there's something to be said for it, like to think in a given era, like here we are in this era, and say your kids will be in 20 years, you know, 15, 20 years, what would really help them for the next 60 years of their life when they're going to be adults, you know, and have to make it in the world in one way or another? They might have an entrepreneurial spirit, which is a great thing, but then they have to know how to make it as an entrepreneur. They might love sports, but then they should be able to have some amount of excelling at that. Not just for when they're adults, like that would be kind of unusual. Like just like, okay, well, I want my child to be a movie star. Well, okay, like one in a million children gets to be a movie star. One in a million adults becomes a movie star. One in a million adults becomes the best tennis player in the world. However, that you have skills, that you have some skills and some things that you can feel some self-esteem around, she felt is very important. And I've thought about that too, and I don't know if I could raise my children as strictly as she did. It's a good read. For parents, it's a good read. I don't think you'll take it up. But I doubt it. But there are some really wonderful things in that book to understand and maybe value in your own way. A child only gets to be a child for the first 20 years and really only for the first 12 years, you know, and then they're taking the parents through, you know, so many things, right? And so they have to have what they need for the rest of their life. You know, there's a lot of skills and things that they need to have. They have to have self-esteem to be able to hold their own in the society, that type of thing. And so I think that is something to be considered, you know. In the States, I mean, all of us, in my family, and almost all families, everybody had to have their several years of piano lessons. So we all had piano lessons. We had to go to ballet class. So all of us were in, all of us together. we all had our little tutus and we went and learned ballet for a few years. I had to go and, which this one I like, but acrobatics. So I had to go to the, but I liked doing that, you know. But there were all these extracurricular things that I think parents do for their children. And they look for things maybe that they really like or love to do. And then they encourage that, you know, so that they can, if they have a natural inclination for something, then they encourage that development. So really, so that they can feel that there's something worthwhile about them. There's something they have to contribute. I don't think I can really do the book justice, but I think just talking about it kind of will bring it into your mind and you can think about it personally for your own life and your own self. in ways that are useful. My parents were really strict. But that part, I don't resent that at all. I have a problem with the lack of communication. But I don't have any problem at all with kind of the, you know, the strictness and the boundaries, and in their mind, you know, everyone goes to college, that's it. You know, I don't think it's like that now, but in my era, it was like that. You have to go to college, you have to get your degree, you have to think of what you want to do. There wasn't more any more talking than that. It's just you're going. You know. So, but the problem with it, you may not want to do that, but then when you're older, then sometimes those degrees open doors for you, even though without the degree, you may be way more competent. I mean, I know so many situations like this, way more competent, way more educated, way more capable, but the ones who get hired are the ones who have degrees. I think this is actually kind of starting to change now, but the reason that it's changing is not a good reason. This is the States, I don't know how it is in Europe. It's because the quality of education is going down so much that people don't have the same respect. The kids don't have the same respect for gaining degrees. And also the people who are hiring don't have the same respect for who's coming out with those degrees, unless it's really a professional degree. So the whole respect for the educational system is less than it used to be. You know, but if it opens doors and you can do it and you have some desiring or inkling to do it, it does open doors for when you're older, you know, makes things more possible to you, for you. And so in that way, it's a good thing. I think letting children, of course, in Swamiji you always talk about this, because India, all of this is so strict. It's absolute necessity, which now this is way beyond what anybody thinks it should be. But for in India, the parents, their child has to be the top of their class, not number two. They have to be the top of their class. And there's only one person who's the top of the class. So that's a tremendous pressure, and they're disappointed if they're not. This is, of course, not every parent, but it's there. And then the child has to go to a good, be accepted and go to a good university. And then they're also really pushed to really either be a doctor or an engineer or somebody high in the tech industry. Just whatever are the best, most respected things, and they push their children toward that in a very strict way. The kids have to study, they have to get their A's, they have to do well. So, but then, so those kids go through all of that, but then when they graduate, they have a good job, they get a good job, and they make a lot of money, you know, and they have a certain amount of security, and they have a certain place in the society. If you don't go through all of that, so you don't go to college, you don't go get your 2-year degree, or you don't get your BA and all of this, you have just as much skill. I mean, I consider school, I have a lot of BS. I don't have that much value for it. Other than the door, now, how it is now, other than the doors that it opens for you, you know. And I really suffered getting my psychology degree to become a psychologist. I wanted to be a psychologist. That's the only way I could do it, because it was excruciating to sit through some of those classes, 3-hour classes, sitting through them at night. It was a nightmare. Still don't even like to talk about it. Anyway, it was hard. It was really hard, but I couldn't be a psychologist. I wanted to be a Jungian analyst, you know, because I loved Jung, and I was doing so much work in that field, and I really wanted that. So you have to go and do it and get the degrees and get the qualifications that you need to be able to do that. Unless you're like a Bill Gates or a person who has a lot of drive to break through kind of the glass ceilings and walls that are surrounding you. And I don't know if it's that Here I think maybe things are different because you can actually go to school for free and go at any time that you want to go, basically. Say you're 40 and, I think I will go to school after all. You have so many opportunities to do that type of stuff here. But for us, there isn't. There used to be, but there isn't. Anyway, I know that you all have different thoughts about all of that, but I'm just saying that according to my tiger lady, you know, preparing your child to be able to function effectively in the world, I think, is really important, and to give the child the disciplines, you know, to be able to have self-discipline, you know, to be able to do things that you don't want to do. One of the things Swamiji has brought up before is how he was trained and what he does to this day. When you have a list, you have your list of things you have to do, your to-do list. So you have that list. He will always do the ones he doesn't want to do first. And also, I've known this about him, and I've seen it for years, it works really well. And another thing that he's learned, but you know, you have to be taught these things. I mean, it's helpful if you're taught these things. The other thing was that, which is similar, if something comes up that could be done right now, like say for Swamiji, he gets so many phone calls, you know. And so he can either take the call, you know, or say, tell them I'll call them back. He never does that. He takes the call. And then that is over. That's not on his mind anymore. Or if the secretary, this Dr. Gita, would come, and somebody wants to see Swamiji, you know. And so Swamiji will, if he has any availability, he'll say, okay, let me see them right now. He just does it and gets it done. So he keeps, otherwise, just imagine when you're busy, as you get to be a busy person, I'll call this person later. I will see that person in a little while, you know. And then this whole, you know, mountain of things keep building up, and you can't really manage if you're subject to procrastination. And it's easy, I know for my own self, it's very easy to be subject to procrastination, especially when it's something that you don't want to do. So these are disciplines that take you a long way in life, actually, but they have to be taught from a young age, and not taught in a mean way, but taught in a fun way. So it becomes just the way that you do things. A child learns all of that. But if you don't put up the borders or the boundaries, structure, you don't give them any structure, you don't, you know, teach them to finish what they start and these type of things, then they don't even know to do that. They'll play for something, do something, they have a little task and they get bored with that and they do their next little thing. Because that's how the mind is. The mind is just, I'll do this for a while, I'll do this for a while. What if the parents don't teach you? That okay, you're doing this is your task, and you have to finish it, you know? Then they learn, okay, when I start something, then I should finish it. It doesn't have to be mean at all. It is just giving guidance to give them a structure, a mind that has some structure in it and capacity to accomplish things, you know? Like, I don't know about all of you, if you all had to learn the piano, but we all had to practice for a half an hour. You know, and so every day I had to practice for a half an hour while my mother was in the kitchen cooking, listening. She would listen. She had a perfect pitch, and she would hear me hit something. No, that's not the right key. But anyway, I just want you to understand. Maybe think for yourself about all of this, because I think it's not always something that we think about and really bring into consciousness the importance of that. It's your task to give your child the ability to succeed, and that requires some structure. It requires learning how that there's hard things to do and not always just what you want to do. Sometimes you have to do what your responsibilities are and what you need to do. What if you grow up thinking it's okay just to do the things you want to do? That's That doesn't work very well in life. So, all right, that's a few more things.
Rather than anything.
Yeah.
So now it's grown adults.
Yeah.
So it seems.
Yeah.
How do we do that to ourselves? Say if we're, you know, maybe we can't necessarily ask that. Could the child who didn't get the structure please come forward for a little bit of structuring and.
You mean for structuring for your own self?
Yeah. Like you say, I'm just saying, for example, if we didn't get that kind of structure, discipline.
Well, I think for us as adults, I think there's a lot of things probably that we didn't get, but the ones that bother us that we're aware of, those are the ones to work on. You know, mm-hmm. like. You know, like for me, my worst one probably is correcting papers. I can be such a procrastinator, and it takes so much will for me to start to do it. But I've learned that for these things that I really don't want to do because it's so time-consuming, takes so long, I really don't want to. But what I've learned is once I do the first paper, I can continue. And I will continue because now I've started. So you find little tricks like that, you know, that there's something that you wish that you had more structure, that you were more structured, and then you have to define it for yourself. I do wish I had more structure and was able to handle this type of situation better, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I can work on it, where you make a sin culpa and you're going to try to do it and you check up on yourself. That's what we have to do. If we have no idea that we're not structured in a particular area, you know, your wife will let you know. Somebody will let you know. You know, your work will let you know. But usually just internally we can figure that out. But the thing is, though, is to kind of have a value for it, because it's not trying to make people into automatons. It's just trying to use your time productively rather, because if you don't do it, the problem is that your mind is always, it's always niggling there in the background that this has to be done, I have to make this call, you know, I have to write these letters, but you're not doing it, you just keep pushing it in the back so that you can do what you want to do, but it doesn't go away from the back because you know that it has to be done. And so once you understand these kind of dynamics, you can work on yourself to change that one thing at a time. That's how I would look at it. And then you can realize where you're lacking and wish you had certain natural capacities, those things you can pass on to your children so that they have that. You know? And the values that maybe you didn't get in the way you wished you would have got, like the value for, you know, education or whatever it is, can be. For some of us, it's very hard because what we really love to do is kind of not the thing that makes a lot of money, you know, or not the thing that is easily saleable in the world, you know. But you still need to develop the discipline and the skills to be able to make money or to live off of what you want to do. That Eve said that's entrepreneurial. You have to have the skills and the discipline and the kind of being able to think logically and all of this type of thing in order to pull these things off, or else you're just continually spinning your wheels. So I don't think we always think of these things as skills. That's why I really like this Dragon Lady, Tiger Lady book. It's a really good book. It's not very long either, and then it's kind of shocking to read it, but at the end of it she kind of has a looks back and says, you know, I was probably a little too strict or something, she says. But she also, her children got a lot. They really got a lot. So, even though sometimes the kids were very angry, very angry at her. She wasn't angry at them. She was just strict. She was a tigress. Anyway, I don't know what more to say about it. I'm kind of going around in circles. I'll probably think of something more. But I think it's nice to just have the subject kind of opened up, because you know, you already have children, some will have children, and just kind of remembering back and yourself saying, I wish I would have had a more value for this, or, you know, I wish I could have done that. But a lot of these things are easy to instill in a child, but harder for us when we're adults. Very well. Any more questions? Floating around.
We referenced to the fear that you dealt with yesterday.
Mm.
I wonder if you can explain us fear from a psychological viewpoint, but using the Shastra Bhayam Abhayam Bhayam.
Mm-hmm.
There is no fear when there is no sense of duality.
Yeah.
So how would you translate this concept in terms of Western thinking? Is it related to the sense of isolation or belonging? Or
I think that fear is instinctual, something that will kick in. And a lot of times I think that fear is not... certain things that are really fear-based, we don't acknowledge as fear. So that's kind of what I've been trying to talk a little bit about. What is this bhayam abhayam? And I think fear is very highly related to my desires, my rugged wishes. And so the fear will come up in this way, especially in reference to people or who are in some way an obstruction to something that I really want. Those people become sources of fear, even though you may just think that you don't like them, or you know they're not helpful people or whatever, and you're just projecting everything, all of your anxiety and anger out on them. But if you get into the habit of asking when you're feeling that way, usually about a person, you have some negative take on the person, you don't want them in your life, you wish they'd never come into your life, all of these kind of, you know, pretty strong feelings. If you ask yourself, what am I afraid of? I mean, within our group, within Vedanta, we can ask this kind of thing, you know. What are you afraid of in reference to this person? And what it usually amounts to is that, you know, this person will take away kind of the nice security or shanti or beautiful life that I was planning on having, because if they're in my life, I won't have that. They will ruin it, you know, because they're so difficult to deal with. So then in reference to that person, you don't want them to come into your life because they cause too much disruption and hurt. And if they're going to stick on you like glue, then, and you can't shake them off or get rid of them, then your whole life is going to be a life of suffering because of the way that they are, the way this particular person is, the problem that they have and all of that. And so I'm afraid of that suffering. Or that person is going to somehow take away something that I'm afraid that they, it's all fear. I'm afraid they will take away something that's really important for me. It's for my own happiness. And so usually we don't label it as fear. But I think it's very helpful to see that it's not that what I'm worried about is my own shanti, my own happiness, the happiness of my life, the happiness of my setup. This person and the way they are, the way they treat me, the way they are toward me can really ruin all of that. And so I fear them, and I fear them in my life, you know. And so the solution, and there's many solutions to this problem, I suppose, but the main solution, I think, for somebody who has knowledge, if that kind of thing comes up, is to label it for what it is. Because once you label it for what it is, you're also recognizing very much that in yourself you're projecting your ananda on a certain type of person or a certain type of even situation, a certain type of situation that you need to have. in order for you to be happy. And this person, whatever, is an obstruction to that happy life. That's, I think, pretty common. But we don't label it like that. So say once you realize, that is what I'm afraid of. Then you can actually bring your knowledge in. You can bring in Ishwara, you know. You can bring in things that make sense to you, you know, in terms of your knowledge that can help to dissipate that projection. Like if I get into some situation like that, I love what Swamiji once said, you know, if it's yours, you'll get it. And if it's not, you won't. So there's nothing to worry about. You know, let the prarabdha unfold. And so then say, you can also say it in different ways. You know, if you've got some papa to go through, it'll be there and you'll be able to go. You'll get to go through that papa. If you've got some punya that's good there, that'll be there, and then you'll deal with that. You know? But don't worry about it. You know, it's all part of the prarabdha. Just deal with what's there to the best of your ability. That's what I do every day. He said this in different ways, but I love that. It's what I do every day. I do what's there to be done. You know, I take care of whatever my duties are to be done and do the best of my ability. And then if I'm still here tomorrow, again, I do what's here to be done to the best of my ability. You know, and then I start having a different vision about life and about life being something that has to make me happy, and this person is an obstruction to that. Instead of thinking like that, I think it's more realistic and real to think that this is my life and this person is part of my life and there's difficulty there, so that's my sadhana in this today. This is the sadhana for today, to develop in myself the strength to not be upset by this person. Can I just welcome this person as long as I welcome everybody else? That's my task. My task is for my heart to be as big as Ishwara's. That's the task of the Yani. That's our Antakarana Shuddhi task. You know, and so we stop looking at these people that for whatever reason really, really push your buttons. So to the degree that you really don't want them around. They push your buttons and they threaten your happiness. That's your sadhana. That's just Bhagavan. You can look at what we might call papa karmas. You know, they're meant to cause some stress. We need to look at those as our sadhanas. Because the punya karmas are like vacation, you know. It's the papa karmas that we need to be able to be present to and just be objective and do what needs to be done rather than looking at them as somebody trying to ruin my life. Yeah. And what if you think like this? Within the Shastra, you think the life is 50-50 according to the Shastra. 50-50 means about 50-50, punya and papa. And on this loka where we have free will, where we can gain moksha, that means that this is not Swargaloka. That's what Jagadish should always say. It's not Swargaloka. This isn't Swargaloka, you know. I like that. It's true. It's not Swargaloka. So how can we, you know, it's not Swargaloka. How can we complain, you know, about, so this is difficult, this person's difficult. As though nobody's supposed to be difficult. There's not supposed to be any difficult situation. No. 50% are going to be challenging. So how to be with those 50% as sadhana, so it's up to us it's up to us whether a situation hurts or bothers us. Really, it depends on your attitude. It's not really all about attitude, and so like that value of values, as we kind of practice attitudes that are in line with our knowledge. You know, it's kind of circular. We have knowledge, and that knowledge helps us to change our attitudes. And changing our attitudes helps us to more deeply abide in our knowledge. So both ways, we're helping the situation, which is really nice. Yeah. So, I think the more you want to reject a person, the more important that person is in your life. And it can be very, very challenging, because if you want to reject a person that much, they are triggering something big inside. And so you have to work internally. When that happens to you, you have to work internally to see what's really going on there and try to help the little ones inside. And you have to practice externally to say, you know, to just say a kind word, to do a kind gesture, you know. I've told that story so many times. When I was around 30 or so, and there was that person at the ashram where I happened to be in the States with Swamiji, I was there. And this woman, she just, it was impossible for me. And so there was jealousy and of me and all these things involved. It was really awful for me. And so he said, you just go up and you just say something nice to her, walk in, you just do it. Just do that. It's all you have to do. And I said, I can't. I can't do that. Swamiji, I can't. You do it. You do it. You know? And a day would go by and I wouldn't be able to do it that day. I think if I recall, it's hard to remember, but three or four days went by. And I said, I think one time I said, no, I'm not. I can't. And he just looked at me and he very seriously said, you do it. And so, you know, I remember this woman was cooking in the kitchen. And where we'd make all Swamiji's meals. She was a good cook and she was cooking in the kitchen. So I stood at the doorway, just kind of at the edge of the door. I said, okay. And so I just walked in there, and as I approached, so she was cooking on the stove, I just said, hi, how are you? And I kept going. She said, something, you know. And I kept going right out the back door. But you know what? It made it broke this barrier, because I said something. And so whatever this knot was inside went phew, like that. And that was so shocking to me. I was so shocked that I never forgot it. This is still just this vivid image in my mind. I never forgot it. And I started practicing that when I would have something or something negative towards somebody, I would just do that. And yeah. And so with her, I think I did that a few more times, and then I didn't have that problem anymore. It's such an easy thing. But you can't imagine the level of resistance that you can have for going up towards somebody who has, for whatever reason, been such an incredible source of pain for you. You're just not willing to. And so that takes a lot of courage, a lot of discipline, a lot of strength to do it. But once you do it, it's so rewarding that you're willing to do it again. So that's the type of way we have to work with ourselves, because the rewards are so great and they are immediate. It's not something later, it's something immediate. And so we have to learn all of these little, you know, they're like your little toolkit. We all have to carry around our little toolkit for the psyche, how to really grow inside. It has to be, we gain this knowledge and we gain antakarana shuddhi. Antakarana shuddhi is some work. It takes some work. It takes commitment. You know? And knowledge takes commitment too, but it's different because it's kind of easier. You know? It's easier than going against these fears. Yeah. Been feeling threatened. We can talk more about it.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Namaha Hari Om.